This is Leon Clue. He's the head of the South African, or the CEO of the South African Institute of Tax Practitioners. Behind me is Nicholas Schombeke, and he represents was the technical officer of the accredited certified of accountants, chartered accountants, sorry. And we've just put this presentation together, and it sort of represents the scene of all three of us here, but I'm representing the two institutions as mentioned above here. What I'm going to do is just give you a very quick in three slides of world economic background, where we are. I'm going to talk a lot about jobs as well, and I'm going to talk about revenue, why we can't tax much more, where things are going there, a little bit about the expenditure. Nicholas will talk a bit about tax simplification and job creation. This is the world as it is today. I know it's a very small thing, but you can see South Africa at about the 10,000 international dollars. This is purchase power parity. So we're not really poor. We're rich or poor as Brazil and countries like that. The problem is, on the other side, is that our life expectancy is very low. It's at 52 years. It's probably why Provin Gordon gives people off taxes off at 75 years. Those are the things, you know, if you go back to Bismarck, that's what happened there as well. He gave the Germans a very good idea of that they were going to get a pension from the state about 120, 130 years ago. And he said you can get it from age 65, and the average German only lived to 40 then. But anyway, that puts things into perspective. You can see that, in a sense, there's a few things that we need to address here, but there's also opportunities. And it's not so much the money that's lacking, I think, in South Africa at the moment, just in South African terms, but we need to go forward to where our competitors are. If you want to get this information, it comes from an organization called gapminder.org. It's free of charge on the internet. It even moves in time, and you can see where countries have been, and that type of thing. The emerging markets are really the leading growth market at the moment. It's not just the Chinese, the Indians and Brazilians and Russians and so on. It's a lot more today. It's Vietnam, it's Thailand, so on. They've really been doing very, very well on the growth stakes. You can see the world average is sort of in the middle. And the developed world is a little bit at the end. But we must remember one thing. The developed world is still about half of the world economy, the emerging markets being the other half. And they're still very important trade partners to us. So we've come out of a recession, but it seems this year people like the Economist Intelligence Unit, this graph I'm using here, expect a bit of a slowdown in world growth, so does the IMF and the like. Just the background to where we are, the OECD industrial production back at zero after a big bounce back. So we expect interest rates around the world to remain low. But that gives you an idea that things are still a bit fragile, and as you yourself said earlier on, hopefully we don't have another meltdown. But in the industrial world, there's already countries that are again in recession. I'm not saying that's going to happen here right now, but it is just a little bit of a warning sign, so there wasn't much room to maneuver. Here's a return of the oil price. On a daily movement, you can see the North African and Middle Eastern protests, revolution, or whatever you want to wish to call it, and its effect on the oil price, and that will certainly have an impact on our inflation rate going forward because there's a knock-on effect that one can expect. But that's the background to the world economic economy. Let's just have a quick look at South Africa. Our GDP has bounced back somewhat from the Great Recession, this being the biggest recession we had in 27 years. It's also the second highest growth rate in more than 2.5 years that we had in the fourth quarter. So that's reasonably okay, but it's not brilliant. It's not quite 100% as high as it was as you talked in 2005 and 6 numbers, and that's where we are right now. But getting to the main thing, and I think this is the room to maneuver, if you look at South African statistics, South Africa's statistics, now everybody complains about the statistics. The problem is in the definition. So if you turn South Africa's stuff around, you say, who's actually working and who's not working? That's not just unemployed, because to be unemployed is a very difficult thing these days. You actually have to go out looking for a job in the last 4 weeks. You can't just go to a personnel agency. You have to want to start right away. And for many people in a rural area, that's difficult. even being a discouraged work seeker is quite difficult for people in rural areas because they think a job is going to be in the city, but it's going to take some time to set themselves up in the city. So even that's difficult. Now, under not working, we also unfortunately include students and housewives and so on, but just gives you a broader outline. And we've got about 13 million people working and 19 million people in South Africa of the adult population not working. That's not a good situation to be in, and that means that there's a high dependency ratio in South Africa. It gives us very, very limited room to maneuver. Another way to look at it is your active labor force as a percentage of the adult population, and that's been coming down over the last decade. You can see it here. And that's quite a scary number in as such, and that's as a percentage of the adult population. And the employed has also declined somewhat. There was a bit of a take-off during our good growth period. But just to put things into perspective, we would be in the bottom 12 out of 189 countries as regards to our active labor force. Our neighbors are countries that you might have heard of recently, like Tunisia and Egypt and so forth. So this puts us in a very, very bad situation. And we must remember Muslim countries generally don't allow their women to work. So our men are actually doing very, very badly as regards to participating in the labor force worldwide type of thing. So you wanted to know what it would cost you to create jobs. Now, there are two tables here, if you wish. The one is the 9 million that you refer to, Mr. Chair, from Treasury, and the other one is the 5 million jobs that we refer to. Now, 5 million, let's just put it that way, is underperforming. Because just to get back to the average emerging market, assuming that South Africa is an average emerging market, Treasury has mentioned 56%. I think that's also a little bit of a low number. They've probably cut out one or two of the higher performing emerging markets out of that. But nonetheless, you need about 9 million jobs, they say. And the other side, we say we're going to shoot for 5 million jobs. Now, if we create those jobs in the private sector, and the cost of a job is not just the money you pay people, it's also the inventory, the computer that you have to put on, the table, the rented space, and all that type of stuff, then you would need to grow at 4.9% to create 5 million jobs every year, and that's without making anybody of the current workers any wealthier. In other words, you're saying the people that are currently working in South Africa, the 13 million, would have to be happy with no pay increases whatsoever, just inflation, let's put it that way. And if you take it at the government rate, because the government pays a lot better, you'd have to grow at about 6.5%. And then we have industrial policies, and just to show you how difficult it is when you go into capital-intensive type of stuff, the motor subsidy rate, which was given to us in this budget as well, for the amount of jobs that are created, you'd have to grow at 13.3%. Not a good idea. Now, if we want to grow the 9 million jobs, you have to grow private sector rates at roughly 7.5% to 8%, government rates at 10%, and motor subsidy rates around 19%. But if you want to make people that are currently employed also a bit motivate them, and this is assuming people that are employed can keep the same productivity and everything like that, you would have to add at least 2, probably more like 3 or 4% maybe even, but let's say 3%, you would have to, at private sector rates grow then for the 9 million jobs, you would have to get to a point where you grow roughly at 10.5%, 11%, for government rates 13%, we've never done that. And at motor subsidy rates of about 21%, nobody in the world has done that. So we would need to create a new world record in the growth rates. So that's impossible. So we've got a serious problem. We haven't got enough people working, and we certainly have got people paying quite a lot in money for some of those jobs. Now, if we look at government wages as a percentage of GDP in 2008 or later, we can see that we're one of the higher paying countries in the world. We're very much similar to the rich countries. That's how much we pay our government service. If you look at the Denmarks and the Swedens, we're not quite there, but we're very close to the France, the Belgians, and the Norway. So if we look at, for example, other countries like Nigeria, down here at the 5% mark, not at the over 12% mark that we are, and we're going to fill those government wages up a bit. We're probably wanting to grow past France and more Portugal here with the amount of people. So we're already spending a heck of a lot of money on our government wages. You need to know that because this is something that we're going to have to look at very, very carefully. If we look at the amount of formal employment in the total public sector, this includes state-owned enterprises, you will see we're as high as we're higher than the Netherlands, the Czech Republic, and so on. And remember, many of these countries are considered welfare states already. So we're already at a very, very high rate. one of the highest rates in the world. I didn't find many other African countries' statistics on this, but this just gives you an idea that we're very much in front of the developed world. We're in the top three countries, vis-a-vis in the other numbers I get from the OECD. So this gives you an idea that very many people are already employed by the public service of South Africa. So there's not much room that we can maneuver there, and we can't create many jobs in the government service, therefore, because we want to either employ everybody in the government service, that doesn't really work. If we look at the adult categories in South Africa and we look at the actual annualized growth rate from 2000, we can see that the number of people unemployed has actually declined, but I would gather that that is a bit more of a definitional change over time. The labor force has increased with about 0.5% a year. The employed has increased with about 0.7% a year. But the problem is that your population has been growing at 1.5% a year, so in essence, that's made up of, again, the non-economically active part of the population, those people that we sometimes say are just not working, but they're not looking for a job, so they can't be unemployed. It's a definitional thing. So the non-economically active part of the population has been growing 2.7% a year. And that's the problem that we have. We haven't created enough jobs in the last decade already. And I heard what the Fiscal Commission said here, but I think if you actually look at the labor force statistics, it says to you that we haven't really created many jobs at all with all the growth rates in the last decade. Yes, there was a bit of a slaughter of jobs during the recession period. I would take that into account. But it says to me we have to do better and we have to grow a lot quicker to absorb people, or we're going to have a different type of problem here. Where the job growth has been is in the government sector over the last 4 years at about 15%. More jobs in the government sector. The private sector has actually decreased to 2.6%. The Great Recession played a huge role. And that's a big thing as well. Why isn't the private sector creating jobs in South Africa? Because essentially that's what we're all going to need to be done. So let's just have a quick look, step back where the jobs are in the formal sector, non-agriculture. Government has about 1.8, but these are all just rounded, 6.3 in the private sector. Domestic workers, about 1 million. Informal sector, about 2.5 million. The rest of the 13 million are in the formal and informal agriculture and other categories, if you wish. But that makes up the South African workforce. If we look at the employer numbers in the middle of last year, we're looking at 1.77 million people who are employers. One of those, 1.1 million people employ themselves only. 100,000 people employ one other person. A quarter of a million people employ between two and three other people, and 301,000 employers employ four or more people other than themselves. They also employ nearly 7 million people, and they make up more than 85% of the formal private sector, I just need to say that. Let's first go and have a look at the self-employed. We've had a lot of people that were self-employed in 2001 or so was 2.2 million. We then declined before the recession to about 1.7 million in 2006. And now we're only at 1.1 million. So we have to ask ourselves, why are the self-employed no longer self-employed? Why have they moved on? Why are they going away? Those are the things, because these people take care of themselves. And you can see at their sort of medium earnings from Statistics South Africa, you can see it's about 1,800 rand per month that they pay. Then in the formal sector, those that we estimate are in the formal sector pay about 7,000 rand a medium with their sum. The average income would be a little bit higher. There's a difference quite a bit, but we would say roughly 11 to 12,000 rand per month. They work very long hours. We've had surveys on that. So we know that the self-employed are quite industrious people, but they're disappearing. This is the problem. Okay? If we go and have a look at the top end, there's 301,000 employers using 2009 tax statistics and labor force statistics, combining the two. They make up less than 1% of our adult population. There's fewer of them. In pure economic terms, it means if you have very few, okay, it's something that's very precious. We should be looking after them a lot more than we are at the moment. We should be giving these people tax breaks. If they want toilets built on the left-hand side, we must ask them if we shouldn't build those toilets also on the right-hand side so that we can satisfy them. If they say that there are potholes in the roads, you say, okay, we're getting rid of the potholes and we're also building you a newer road. Don't you want a road to your business? If the guys want a dam, you say, can't I build you two? Because these are the people that are creating jobs. They're very scarce. And things that are scarce need a lot of money. And they pay around 90% of all company taxes. They pay about 84% of personal income taxes via their employees. The average firm size in South Africa is already down from about 34 in the 1980s to about 12 people. So those firms are coming down in size. We need to ask ourselves why that's happening. That comes from UIF data. That's why I put it there. And the 301,000 is down from 320,000 in 2002. That's about a 6% decline. Now, if I say 20,000 jobs have disappeared with 12, or employers have disappeared with 12 jobs each, say, just never mind the 34 jobs, then that's quite a number of people. That's nearly a quarter of a million people who've disappeared because those employers have disappeared. That's horrible. Shouldn't be allowed to happen. And yes, it's been a tough time for them. They've also felt the recession and everything, but that puts it down. Just another few things on that. We think that it's a very low number worldwide. We haven't got all the worldwide statistics. But just to put things into sort of more same numbers, in the United States, we gather that it's about 4% of employers are people that employ four or more people. So there's a heck of a lot more industrious people, at least in the United States, that are employers and so on. We need to ask ourselves the question, how do we make life easier for them? We need to really do a lot of things. We mustn't get them to fill out more forms. We must get them to fill out less forms. Okay, that's the basic. We must get them to fill a lot of those. We should start with an attitude that we need those private sector firms. China went very, very different. So said it would be then. But China then put things differently, and they sort of said, okay, it's glorious to be rich in the 1980s, and they made a big change. We must get away from talking about the poor. We must start talking about the rich. And that's not forgetting about the poor. That's the only way that the poor are actually going to be part of this economy, is if we start servicing those guys that are employers. They're the people that can do things, and they have that, and they've proved themselves over the many years. South Africa needs to ask what these firms need and want. For example, let's take Cipro. I've got a small firm. I employ two people full-time, it's my personal capacity, and two people part-time. I also employ other people from time to time on an ad hoc basis. But Cipro deregistered me because I didn't fill out a form that my accountant had to fill out. I have to then go 400 rand. I have to go to the bank to thicken myself, and the bank's very worried because they watch the Cipro stuff. So according to me anyway, all this type of nonsense, you've just created trouble for me. So I think let's close Cipro. There we can save quite a lot of money overnight, finished, blah, put them in the streets. They must now sort themselves out because they've just created hassles for lots of firms. Okay. So I also have to pay an accountant to fill in all these things. So, and it creates a hassle for my accountant and myself because I'm here representing accountants. So I think we must just think about this stuff. And what are we doing with the Cipro data where everybody's data is coming together? Are we using it for any statistical gathering purposes? Are we doing anything with it? Or is it just a way to get a great idea, how do we get firms to fill out more forms? Okay, so we must need some. Then just on the tax side, this budget again, 14 million is the small business limit. Let me tell you, 14 million for somebody that's got a garage. Garage is about an 8% margin. Out of that, he's got to pay rent, he's got to pay wages and so on. That's a very, very small amount of money. So we need to lift that small business thing from 14 million rand in today's terms. That's very little as a turnover, and we should increase that to 24 million, 48 million, wherever. But that's what we need to do. Then also the 300,000 has not moved in years. So you're not giving small businesses breaks at all. You're just helping them down the line to pay more taxes. And that's the problem that we have at the moment here. If we look at CETA, the CETA, for example, means nothing to a small firm. They want my money when I start paying wages of over 500,000, but many small firms can't afford to take their people away for CETAs for training and all that type of stuff. So the CETAs just become another form of tax. Let's go and have a look at local government, and I'll talk about local government just now. I've been a member of the Johannesburg Business Forum, which is the local government and business for more than 10 years now. I've gone through these type of things. I have more experience there than so many others. But local government collects 3.5 times more taxes from businesses. They charge businesses more than they charge people. Okay, they charge them more for electricity, refuse removal, water, etc. Our electricity rates already are comparable on the municipal level with those of Western European countries who have a lot more renewable sources of energy, who have a lot more richer customers, and so on. Small businesses are not included or not spoken to in any local economic development plan. Here I have a lot of nice academics coming together and some politicians to talk about local economic development, but you aren't talking to the people that are actually developing, that are actually growing the economy. I think you can get sillier answers. There's just a thing. You know, why do all these laws? The other day I was called by my bank. Apparently they didn't have my FICA documents either anymore because a warehouse burned down. So I have to go and spend another half an hour or an hour in the bank, and I could have spent that more productively creating work for myself. The fact that I don't have a website at the moment is because the two providers want me to fill in. I want to go away from one provider and go to another, and I have to fill in 22 pages, according to this provider, it's a big one, 22 pages to get RICA'd. Do you realize what the laws are that you've created? Okay? King 3, it means absolutely nothing. You can't grow the economy by rules and regulations. The people that you're going to make rich are lawyers and accountants. And they're going to tell you how clever you are. But they're not going to grow the economy. So we need to find a way around all these laws. And a lot of these laws that are written by these parliaments today are used by organizations to scare the living shit. Sorry for this word. To scare the living shit out of small businesses. They come to you and they say, oh, do you know that there's a new turnover tax and this and this and this? Oh, do you know this? Do you know that? And lots of consultants get onto the bandwagon and they tell you about your transformation, your BEE and all these things and how they're going to close you down if you don't do this and that. You're scaring businessmen in this country when you should be at their knees asking them how you can help them. You need to understand this very, very, very clearly. Let's have a look at the revenue. South African government already charges us. The budget is a bit of a misdemeanor offense. Sorry, Matthew, but it is. The 1 trillion in income is if you include all government revenue, in other words, local governments. Government makes up 36% of GDP today, roughly speaking. That excludes state-owned enterprises. This is already a governmental state. It's not developing, though. We need more efficient government because if government fails, we all fail. We want government to succeed, okay? But if government needs to succeed, it also needs to make sure that businesses succeed. Let me just show you a different picture of who collects what revenue. 74% of the revenue is what you had in this budget. 1% goes to the provinces and their budgets. The social security taxes are about 3%, and then you, this is using tax statistics and local government statistics also that you can get from the Treasury website, and then you look at local government, and it's now 22%. Did you realize that that's how government was actually split? So local government charges quite a bit of taxes in itself. So if you take a look also over the last 8 years, the growth rate of different taxes, you can see that total tax revenue did increase more than GDP, so the state is growing. This is just, again, national taxes. Personal income tax grew quite a bit, so all these things that people tell you you got taxed off, you didn't, because you ended up, fewer workers are paying more in taxes today. That's what it boils down to. Value-added tax grew about the same rate as GDP, so that's what one would expect because it didn't change over time. Corporate tax, similar rates, but you can see the secondary tax on companies grew a lot quicker. Then all the other taxes, fuel levies and so forth. The other taxes include Eskom's little 2 cent taxes or government's 2 cent energy tax and so on. That just gives you from stats as well. We just updated that a bit. That's where it comes from. The majority still comes from persons and then companies, and that are the big three. If we look at who pays those taxes, you can see there's many taxpayers that are registered in the bottom salary categories and then fewer in the big categories, but let's see who pays that tax or where it comes from. Two-thirds of the tax comes from our salaries and wages. Pensioners pay about 3.2% of the taxes. If you include RAs, it's about 5%. So we're taking 5% from our old people to pay our personal taxes. That's quite something. Annual payments, that's your bonuses and the like, are about 11%. Commissions about 4%, and directors' fees are about 6%, overtime 3%. Gives you an idea where it comes from on the personal tax side. But let's have a look at this, why you can't tax more. You have 13 million working people in South Africa. We told you about the 19 million that aren't working. We have 5.9 million of them are registered for tax. Of the 5.9 million, only about 5.1 million are liable to submit a tax return, that the state that comes from SARS. And we estimate only about 4.6 million are actually liable for tax. If some people, for example, that make a loss, a farmer could make a loss, or a small businessman, and the like. And that puts it out there. But of that, that's 4.6 million people, all right, pay all our personal income tax. All of it, all right? That's three times less than the amount of people on welfare. Think about that. So for each personal taxpayer, we have to say thank you because you're carrying three people. We have to say that. The other end of it is that there's 2.1 million taxpayers that earn more than 150,000 rand. Many of them are teachers, some of them are nurses, and the like. They pay 90% of all taxes. They're the really rich. So when we had the public sector service strike, we had the really rich in South Africa go on strike, but they thought they were poor. Makes you think. You've got to think about this. These are the actual realities of things going on in this country at the moment. That's just our government revenue. You can see the recession and so on. This includes then our estimate of local government revenues, because I don't think local government can claim that they're charging you for electricity and it's not a tax, not with a 70% gross operating profit built into it from a monopoly. If local government, that's the way local government operates. If you operate like that in the business, you'll have the Competition Commission down your throat so quickly you won't even know it. Let's took a look at corporate income tax. These are the OECD countries. These are the rich countries of the world. As a percentage of GDP, corporate income tax is roughly 4% or less for their companies. Here in South Africa, we're at about double that rate. So we're milking our companies quite tremendously. So that's why you have to say thank you to 301,000 people. You have to really say thank you. Okay, because if they go, then you go too, because they won't be taxpayers. Personal income tax, this year we've worked out about 8.4%, very much like the rich world. Yet taxpayers get very, very little back. So again, the OECD, that's the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, they represent 30 big economies in the world, and you can see where we fit in with that. So I think we have to really think about this, where we get this in. And remember that the firms that are paying for these taxes are not just paying costs to you. They're paying costs for bookkeeping, accounting, and they need this stuff to go and simplify the taxes. Nicholas will talk about that. And so on. They need to keep their paperwork for years because we've got bills that say so. They need to spend their own time on working out their taxes, which is also a cost. And then they have to comply with other laws in order to pay their taxes, because to get a electronic filing, you have to be RICA'd for your thing, and to have a bank account, you need to be FICA'd, and a host of other laws. So we need to really think about this, because we've put these people through a lot. The consolidated government expenditure, let's just have a look. Just national government is about 977 billion. You've seen that in the budget. I'm not going to bore you with that. 1.1 billion rand, or trillion rand, if you wish, sorry, in American trillions, is what it would be if you include local government. The biggest government spending is on education. I think you know that. So if we go and have a look at what we've got here, we've got an education spend that's very, very high. Yet our kids don't compare well to African countries that spend less than a third on education. This year will be the time that we spend more than 12,000 rand per child at school. But we don't get a very good outcome at the moment. And, you know, a 30% pass rate, if businesses only pay 30% of their taxes, you'd be in serious trouble. So we need to think about what we get out of our taxes as well. It's not just what we put in, but what we get out. If you look at all these other things that government spends on, they all go up to about 11% of GDP, but government on employees makes up 40%. It's just over 12% of GDP. So government employees is the biggest expense. We need to get better productivity out of it. That's what it basically boils down to. Who gets the highest salary? As you can see here, this is from the Quarterly Labour Force. It's a bit old, but it just gives you an idea, and it's been going on for a long time. Government employees get paid better than the private sector, especially state-owned enterprises. This year, Eskom will go through an average salary of a $500,000 each. If you want to create jobs at that rate, and that cost, be my guest. You know, you can compare Eskom salaries with some of the highest salaries in America in utilities right now. So it's something that we need to think about for a developing country, quite frankly, and there's many other aspects to it. The budget deficit, we don't really have a problem. We understand that the world is still a fragile place and that the budget deficit will be a bit bigger. As long as it does come back down in line, I think what most businesses are saying to you, and we understand you can't, but at some stage we also need to look at addressing this, but I think for now that's fine. I'm going to hand over to Nicholas. He'll talk about tax simplification. Thank you.
I'll be very, very brief. This is just to show in a very tangible manner what could be done for those 301,000 employers. We know that in 2005, the then Minister of Finance said that they plan a rewrite of the Income Tax Act. Now, this led to the Tax Administration Bill, which is a consolidation bill. It makes the legislation easier to understand, eliminates overlaps and inconsistencies. So that is a very good example of how legislation could be made easier. However, the suggestion is that we need to go further. So the suggestion is, which we want to propose, is a consideration for something which the United Kingdom recently started. They created an Office of Tax Simplification. And what the intention is to create an independent body to make recommendation to Parliament directly, consisting of quite a large stakeholder groupings, small businesses, tax professionals, academics, and government, to look at the Income Tax Act, not to provide new content. We're quite happy and satisfied with the Cuts Commission's proposals on capital gains tax and VAT and residence base. But to just, perhaps it's time since 1994 to have a re-look at our Income Tax Act and see how we can simplify the administration costs for small businesses. So what would such an office do? Identify areas of tax system that cause most of day-to-day complexity. We know currently SARS is quite active in this regard, but it's not part of a broader consultation grouping or an independent grouping that could make political independent advice, I suppose, if you will, provide independent advice and consider the impact of simplification on all business sectors, especially the small business sector. So the question that needs to be answered, how can tax law be simplified? Do we change the content or just focus on redrafting? The admin burden of tax compliance should be part of a national debate, not part of a study group. Identify tax relief that can be repealed, modified, streamlined, or delivered in a different way so as to make the tax system simpler. And we believe by doing this, there might be a way out of the tax labyrinth and address some of the concerns of the small business in the country. Thank you very much.
That's a mouthful. Thank you to Mr. Schussler and his team for an interesting presentation. Very interesting the remark that was made. We want government to succeed, then business will succeed, which I captured here. Our Kenyan delegation is still with us. 78% of the labor force in Kenya is in the agricultural field. I think something that we can take from that country. Honorable members, we are pressed for a bit for time. We still have a few organizations to present. Sangogo, are you ready? We're going to listen to you, and then questions will be posed to these two organizations. Are you ready? Do you, honorable members, do you have the presentation of Sangogo? Put up your hand if you don't have it. The officials will look after you. There's a hand at the back. Time until 12:15. And then we'll take questions. Please introduce your team, or are you alone?
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair. I think it is an honor and a privilege to us, Sangoko, to be allowed by the Honorable Portfolio Committee of Finance to make an oral presentation. Indeed, we are grateful at Sangoko because I think it is a good platform for us to air our views as well as our concerns that I think are for the benefit of the country. My name is Jimmy Kotjana. I'm the national president of Sangoko, which is an umbrella body of all NGOs, non-governmental organizations in the country. I'm being accompanied by my Secretary General, Me Nivuo Sikuba, as well as a strategic member, Pelisa Nkomo. Let me start by saying, Chair, that we have made some revision on the first draft, which was relayed to your office yesterday. Today, I'll be speaking on what has been made so as to inform the House. Elisa, can you come and assist me? I think whilst Pelisa she's on her way, I think it is proper for the members to understand that when we receive the invitation of Sangoko for us to prepare this presentation, which will center around the fiscal framework and revenue proposal. We felt that as Sangoko, I think this matter touched base on some of the elements which we'd like to share. First of all, to us, poverty and inequality is a violation of human rights. It is our view as civil society organizations that fiscal instruments at the disposal of government should be utilized to support a coherent social policy which promotes social stability with concrete social development outcomes. The lessons drawn from the global financial crisis is that market fundamentalism is not a suitable economic model to drive economic growth and imbue social development in a society. It is our view that countries must explore new economic growth model which ensure the following consideration. One, should look at full employment, income distribution, income security, developmental trade regime with environmental and social sustainability. The common thread of inclusive growth that runs through the state of the nation address and speech and budget speech is not well articulated in the budget in a tangible form and allocation poor citizens. However, some local welcome 2011-2012 budget speech presented by Minister of Finance, Pravin Gordhan, but remain cautious with serious concern. Of particular note to us is the increase or rise government spending to 94.1 billion over the next 3 years, because we believe that government must play a central role in economic growth through job creation and infrastructure development. We remain concerned about the projected GDP growth of 3.4% as it does not guarantee job creation in economy for labor market to create employment opportunities. The employment must grow at 4% annually. It is our view that many countries across the world are experiencing budget deficit higher than 5.3%, and most economies in developing countries had experienced higher budget deficit in their growth path. Therefore, South Africa is not an isolated case. We note with serious concern the minimal allocation on rural development, as this sector is a backbone for food security, as well provide unskilled labor to the modern economy. The budget fails to recognize the role of the informal economy through resource allocation. We are concerned about the looming massive electricity hikes and possible rates, which will lead to cuts in basic services for poor households. In terms of intergovernmental relations between spheres of government, Sangoko calls for national government to beef up provincial departments and local government, in particular those in health and education budget planning. Both the national, which has received about 47%, and provinces 46% of the lion's share of the equitable public resource, while local government is merely allocated less than 9%. I think we are very much concerned, because we are of the view that local government is the closest sphere and should have been allocated resources to meet the basic needs of the people. We are concerned about the national government's ability to monitor expenditure of conditional grants, limited parliamentary oversight, and delays in implementing the Money Bills Amendment Procedure and Related Matters Act 9 of 2009. However, Sangoko welcomes the allocation of resources to energy and green economy for environmental sustainability. We, however, remain concerned about the lack of substance on the green economy project, both in the budget speech as well as the State of Nation, in the light of this sector potential to stimulate job creation and diversifying special development in our country. We welcome any intervention that seeks to eradicate lack of participation of young people in labor market, which puts them and their family into abject poverty. But the youth wage subsidy assumes that the problem is the pricing of youth labor. This proposal assumes that youth workers are paid more than their productivity in the labor market, and that government, through this intervention, will reduce the cost of labor and boost the demand. This could be an incentive for early exit from the education system. We call for extensive consultation on this matter to ensure broader participation of the social partners, labor, and civil society inputs, I think is going to be required, Mr. Chair. We welcome the addition to the grants, although we note with some perplexity that those receiving foster care grants are receiving a smaller percentage increase, which is about 4.4%, than those receiving old age, disability, or dependency care grants, which is sitting at 5.5%. We are awaiting the long-promised publication of the Comprehensive Social Security Reform paper that both the State of the Nation and Speech Speech has promised. Sangoko welcomes the proposed increases in health expenditure outlined in the budget table by the Minister of Finance. In particular, we welcome the Minister's commitment to significant investment in strengthening the public health sector. However, we are concerned that the additional 11 billion available for the 2011-2012 will not necessarily translate into improvement in the delivery of health care services. In an absence of a reasonable plan that would seek to address endemic and systemic problems with budgeting and expenditure within health department at all spheres of government. On this matter, I must say, Mr. Chair, that the People's Budget Campaign, which comprises of Sangoko, COSATU, as well as Council of Churches, I think tomorrow they'll be presenting more in detail. So some of the issues, you know, could not be provided by us, because we are of the view that more substance will be provided tomorrow. First problem, make it difficult to determine precisely what health service is being delivered, what needs to be delivered, and how much it will cost. The constitutional right to have access to health care services can only be realized if the budget are aligned to objectively identify health needs and priorities, and if sufficient information is available to departments to formulate and implement appropriate budget. On the issue of the national health insurance, as I was saying, I think the people budget tomorrow will elaborate more, as well as the second point, which is implement the Money Bills Amendment Act, so as to strengthen Parliament capacity. On the issue of job creation, Sangoko is pleased that I think job creation has been put as a top priority by Minister, and we hope that the 9 billion for job creation fund commitment will seriously aim at large-scale job creation initiative. However, it is our view that with this in mind, government will show the same vigor and political will to accelerate delivery in infrastructure and service delivery in a way that emulates the run-up to the 2010 Soccer World Cup. In conclusion, we urge Parliament, the National Treasury, and all relevant departments to fulfill their constitutional obligation and provide the necessary oversight and assistance to provinces to ensure the end of poorly formulated budget and an ability to track expenditure adequately. Without such intervention, the state will be unable to deliver on its constitutional promise of access to health care services. One area that does show some promise in this regard, however, is the introduction of measures to combat corruption by tightening controls over tender and public procurement. That said, we as Sangoko pledge to continue to work with the government in ensuring poverty, inequality, social cohesion and unemployment are addressed and the living condition of our people is improved. I thank you.
Thank you very much, and the way you managed your time, that is also a picture of a leader.
Thank you to the presentations made by these two organizations. We will now take questions. A friendly request, just make your question short. Come to the point immediately. Let me start here from this side. Makubela. George. Kurnoff. Mr. Steve Schwartz. Orbuchani to our presenters and organizations is also the chairperson of the Select Committee on Appropriations in the NCOP. Anyone else? Done? Please indicate to which organization you will pose your question. You may start, Holman Makubela.
Thanks, Chairperson. Mine is going to Sangoko. Two questions. The presenter made mention of the minister speech does not articulate a tangible issues. I wanted him just to unpack those tangible things. Which are those? So that we'll be able, but also that the minister will be able to set those things in. Number two, he also welcomed the additional grant, but complained about the smaller grants which was given and shown there or at the president of 4.4. But does not come up with a proposal which will be enough percentage to be, but which will be suitable on that grant. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. George.
Thank you, Chairperson. To Sangoko, you mentioned that the youth wage subsidy proposal should be put to Labour and civil society for input. Now, COSATU has already said that it opposes the youth wage subsidy. What is your organization's view of this subsidy? And then to Mike Schisler, you mentioned the need for a more conducive environment for business to operate in South Africa and thus generate jobs. Do you think that the budget has provided sufficient stimulus to business given the available fiscal space? And secondly, you mentioned the increase in government jobs and the wage bill. The problem is too many unproductive and overpaid civil servants, many of them deployed. What do you think government should do to resolve this problem? Thank you.
Kurnoff.
Yeah. Chairperson, also to Mike Schusler. In your comparison between the salaries of private sector and the state, including some of the main SOEs, have you included the share options and the bonuses paid out to the private sector in that comparison? And then just secondly, do you support some of these high bonuses and share options in the private sector? And if so, doesn't you think Eskom is taking a cue from that?
Well, Steve Schwartz.
Chair, thank you to Mr. Mike Schussler. Just thank you for your input on the impact laws have on business. Now, I understand, there obviously seems to be a deficiency with the NEDLAC process as well, because a lot of those laws are discussed at that level. Could you help us understand that? Could you also help us, some laws do have a regulatory impact study, such as the proposed labour legislation, but obviously there seems to be a disjunct somewhere along the way where you've highlighted the impact that a lot of these laws have had. To take a step forward, the state president announced that he would be having discussions with business. I think they've been held or they were going to be held. Were all these issues raised with the state president at such discussions? And obviously we've got to address the serious concerns that you raised with us. Thank you.
So Charlie.
Thank you, Chair. My question I just want to Yeah, I just want to know in your... I'm interested to know which sectors of the economy do you think can create more jobs and how? And in terms of your assumption on other things, I think you are a bit exaggerating or the assumptions are overstretched in the sense that, for an example, if you are to take your argument that for every taxpayer, one person who's liable for tax kills other three who are on the social card, I think you are over exaggerating there, given what tax do, because it's not like once you are taxed that goes to social cards only. But if you've got, if you want to expand it on that, I'll be glad to hear that. Also, I don't know if you are in the position now to give us a breakdown of the 2.1 million people who earn above 50%, as opposed to just saying majority of them are teachers and nurses. Unfortunately, we happen to know how much of... Yeah, but give a breakdown so that you get a clearer picture. Otherwise, you are also distorting that. It's another exaggeration in my view. So that we get a clearer picture. And lastly, I would want to get a more details as to, in terms of this simplification of tax laws, how will that help in this whole thing of creating jobs? Thanks.
Which is mine will go to the South African Institute for Tax Practitioners, Mike. You have raised the concern that because of the Cipro administration, it gave a perception that to me, most of the small businesses, then they declined because of too much of paperwork that needs to be filled in. You even emphasize the deregistration of those smaller companies, and when they are to register, they need to pay 400 to 300 rand, and that is costly because they are small, they can't afford it. My question then to you will be, as your institution, you are an institution, how much of the training programs have you given to your clients or to those small businesses? Because you are an institute, and you are also supposed to assist the government to empower the people with the knowledge. So how much of that you have done? That is the first one. The second one, I will really get it difficult to say thanks to the 301 employers. Because I'm sitting here and I'm asking myself, you know, those employers have been here for about 20 to 25 years, and some, if not most, all of them, they've actually contributed to be where we are. And the major employer is the government anyway. And because it is the government, then I'm sure Mike, I'll have a problem with that, but it's my problem. I don't think you need to pay any attention with that. The problem I've got is to add on what the last honorable member said regarding the public servants. Did you take the consideration, now you call them being rich, you are not too sure if they were aware that they are rich. Now, did you take into consideration that there's food price increases, fuel increases, so much increases, which has automatically increased the lifestyle or the living style of this, because that's to transport. Most of them, they transport, they don't even have cars. They drive to and fro. So did you take into consideration that to arrive at that? You have also given us a histogram of which indicates that SOEs, the government SOEs, senior executives are more paid. Mm-hmm. We can agree. But what about companies like MTN, banks? How much have they contributed towards job creation from what they get, from their bottom number? How much? And if you're not too sure, what are your projections from the private sector, like the one I've just mentioned? Do you think they can contribute and come up with a better model for government senior executives to be put at an acceptable remuneration package? Thank you.
Thanks, Chairperson. I think I'm just going to try and keep my attention on my as much as the Honourable Chan has already raised issues about exaggeration, I still want to point to that as well. But first, I'm a little bit worried about the statement that Mike has put to us, that we must start looking at the businesses or the rich and not to the poor. And I'm not sure what informs that, whether it is because of the sector that he is representing. Because there is no way that as government we can look at the rich and service the rich and hope for the best that they will take care of the poor. I mean, that if that is what he's saying, I'm sure he's expecting too much from us. But then, much of what Michael said makes sense. Although is that there are areas where you actually exaggerate more to make his point when it is not really correct. The issue that I just wanted to raise, Chair, is the understanding that the level of corporate tax, the level of paperwork required for administration of small businesses will lead to businesses going away and government collapsing. That is an oversimplification of the reality. Surely businesses have been in South Africa for quite a long time. And I actually just wanted to know exactly what informs him to say that businesses will go out and then the government will also collapse, only because of the current levels of corporate tax or the paperwork required. Although I agree with him on the simplification of the paperwork, but to attach a conclusion that the business will go away because of this extra burden that we are having now, I really need some clarity. What informs that? If it is not merely over-exaggeration and intimidation to actually push us to actually concentrate more to his pronouncement rather than moving in logically.
Yes. I think what is coming out of all the presentations is how do we give poor people dignity? When you go to bed tonight, how many people are going to bed without a plate of food? In winter without a blanket? Getting cold. That's the reality we are dealing with. But also, how do we structure the economy to transform the economy to go forward? We are set to go for lunch at 1 o'clock. Lunch won't be 60 minutes. We're going to reduce that. Lunch will be in the just outside the room here where you have your key. There's 50 minutes left. We give 15 minutes to Sangoko. And we'll give 15 minutes to Mr. Schussler and his team. You may proceed.
Since Mike has more questions, I'll probably save some minutes for him. So I'll be very precise in my responses. Thank you, Chair, and good afternoon, honorable members. I think those are the three questions that were posed to Sangoko. I'll probably start with the huge waste stuff. You'd recall that specifically we're calling for government to ensure an extensive consultation and would not probably collectively, society organization, have a collective view.
but the general view really, broadly, is that one, we think that given the context of poverty and inequality in South Africa, we may not need youth wage subsidy, but we're looking for a comprehensive package that looks to address issues of access to education, access to skills development, and as well access to enterprise development. But also we're saying that before public resources are pumped to private sector for wage subsidy, we'd want two critical things to be done. One is an assessment of learnership programs. Government has invested for the last 5 years almost a huge amount of resources, and we'd want an assessment of the impact of that, because private sector were relieved of that, and a certain amount of public resources went to the private sector. Then the second area would be the funding that has been given to CETAs. We must make a review of the CETAs in terms of where is that money being channeled to and how many young people that are being trained. I think the training should as well be in line with the industrial development strategy, which are linked, which will be linked to the key sectors of the economy. So we would not want to produce young people who have skills but also are not able to be economically active because they've acquired irrelevant skills in terms of what the economy demands and for the economy to grow. So that's a broad track, and I think once we begin to interact with the specifics of what the youth wage seeks and how it proposes, then I think we'll deal with the modalities and present a concrete proposal of what we need to decide. I think in relation to ready grants, I think our view is that it's not our call to say what percentage form that the state should be actually be increasing grants, but the issue is that we would want the government to acknowledge the magnitude of poverty and inequality and begin to look at different forms of support that poor citizens will be required. And I think two key areas we're raising. We say the foster care grant has been risen below inflation, because we're saying that anyone else, to any effect, any employer, or all of us here in the room, all of us normally receive our own salary increase that are based on inflation rate. So why would you want poor citizens not to receive anything that is poor inflation related? So we'd want that consciousness. But however, and I think the call we're making is in relation to the comprehensive social security paper reforms that have been proposed, and we'd want to interact with the committee and parliament in terms of what is being put on the table and whether that social security reform would be responsive to dealing with issues of people who are trapped in poverty. And the third issue in relation to the tangible, I think one of the key issues we really raised is that, again, in the context where labour market is shrinking, it's not absorbing labour, but as well as while we're seeing recovery in terms of the economy, but the labour market is not taking on a lot of workers. Would want, when we talk about the tangible, we're looking at how the state resources are moving, which areas the state resources are moving. And there are two critical areas that we think that government has really exercised oversight is the issue of rural development. I mean, we make a point that rural development is not a backbone only for food security, but as well as it provides labour for the modern economy. But not only that, it's actually by not investing resources in that sector, we're missing an opportunity where we could actually be developing the industrial capacity of rural areas so that you can stimulate local production and local economies in that sector. So, and the issue is that when you don't invest funding allocation in that sector, is that the unskilled labor will move into urban communities, where urban communities are demanding skilled people with highly technical skills, because the urban communities are characterized by knowledge-based economy. So in the sense that you're sitting with urban communities who have oversupply of labor, who can't be absorbed by the economy that is in urban areas. So the issue then that we're saying is that then shift your resources where they will really become more effective and be demanded more. I mean, we know the fact that the urban development has received a lot of money, but the question is how much is it able to absorb the current labor supply that is sitting there, that is not being demanded by the knowledge-based economy. That's the tangible we're really talking about. Thank you.
Very briefly,
you want a follow-up?
Chair, yes, I just wanted to check to Sandok on the wage subsidy. Do I then understand that you, in your document, you say the youth wage subsidy proposal is welcome, and we are broadly of the view that government should
consult broadly. The issue of consultation, is that your concern or not?
No, I think the principle we're raising there is that the people, is that the waste, the issue around waste substance should not, it implies or creates an assumption that youth, young people are being highly paid and underproductive. So therefore the state should actually be subsidizing the private sector in providing labor. So we're saying that is the problem. And we'd want to unpack that, hence we're calling for a broader consultation so that we begin to really tease out of what are the real issues that affect young people in them becoming active in the labor market than the issues of labor pricing.
Are you done, Shugo?
I'm giving all my other minutes to Mike.
Okay. Before Mr. Schuessler responds, co-chair Mufumadi wants to make it.
No, it's just probably a follow-up, an addition to what my colleagues have already raised, honorable members, in your response, because your presentation seems to be saying you don't have a developmental stage. You actually went on to say, to make an assertion that we're with a government stage. I just want to give you clarity on that. Secondly, your assertion seems to be saying government is a problem in the economy. But without necessarily taking into consideration, everyone who has made the presentation has been saying we are now out of the economic crisis, we are beginning to regain ground world over. What was the role of the state in the economic crisis vis-a-vis the role of the private sector? Tied to that, what has stabilized the economies of the world today? Is it the private sector or the state? Without necessarily having to hammer on why things happen, I think we are now on a process of saying why should things not remain the same? It's to change. Yeah, I thought I should just, and also in your fourth slide, your analysis in terms of emerging market economic outlook and what has stimulated the economies of China, India, and Brazil, in particular around China, you are saying it is the stimulus effect that has actually contributed to the existing imbalance. If we just explain what was the difference, because I think domestic consumption also played a critical role in China itself, but the only thing is in India here.
Thank you, Honorable Tumadi, Mr. Schuessler, Mr. C. Okay, the first question I need to answer is the budget enough for the business stimulation for, or is the environment created? I think what we're saying is that the environment that the budget is in is a tight environment, and it's very difficult for the minister to make up his revenue needs at this moment in time. But what we'd like to say, we understand that sort of background to the budget, and as far as he possibly could, he's probably tried to give us something. He's trying to put in, and everything isn't sketched out. As the previous guys from the Fiscal Commission also pointed out to you, there's no clear things on many aspects of the job stimulation and so on. The situation of civil servants seems to come up again and again. Let me just say a couple of things. Worldwide, there is a problem at the moment with civil servants. Very often, they get paid better than their private sector, so it's not a unique South African situation. But around the world, we've seen very big changes in civil servants
structures, the way things are working. For example, we know that Greece civil servants are having the salaries decline, made smaller. The benefits of being eroded, we see the same in France, we see the same in Ireland. To give you an idea, I spoke to the Irish ambassador some time ago, they got a 5% pay cut, and the next year they got a 7.5% pay cut. So around the world, this is one of the things that's been made to look out, and even in America, civil servants are having to give up some of the gains that they've made. And what the basic premises of that is that civil servants have not as many risks as employees in the private sector, for example. And the private sector company could close, whereas government is unlikely to close its doors. So in South Africa, we have this strange situation where, for example, civil servants don't have to pay UIF, but those in the private sector must pay unemployment insurance. So there are differences, and certainly that's something that we have to resolve. That's the government civil servants. What we also have in South Africa, if you want to look at it, the state-owned enterprises are starting to have very big salaries. In fact, they compete with some of the best in the private sector. And it's very difficult to go to people and say, you've got to pay more for electricity, when at the same time, the guys that are providing you the electricity, be they at Eskom or at the local municipal level, and they get very big salaries. On average, as I said, this year, Eskom will break through the R500,000 per employee cost to company on their salaries. Now, that's a very high salary in a situation where the average self-employed person or the person in the middle of the self-employed only earns 1,820 rand a month. So how do you compare somebody who's got a job, who's asking us more and more money for that service that he's delivering at 40,000 odd a month, say, compared to somebody who's self-employed, who's living and making a sustainable delivering out of, and these figures come from Stats SA, we may all argue that they are a bit wrong, but the process is still the same. You're looking at somebody that's getting 40,000 rand a month compared to somebody who's getting roughly 2,000 rand a month. So it's a very, very big situation to overcome. The same applies with many state-owned enterprises. We know that the President expects, and the Minister of Finance, and the Minister of Economic Development expects the state-owned enterprises to create some of these jobs. All we're really pointing out is that some of these jobs are just very, very costly at a state-owned enterprise level. That, first of all. Okay, you wanted to know, did I include the private? Well, with the sector's share options included, what we've used is, we think a lot of that is, then maybe not the share options, but certainly bonuses and everything. The number that we're using comes from Statistics South Africa's quarterly employment survey on the formal sector, where you can get a split of up to 95 sectors, and a number of sectors you can make a call as to what our state employees are earning and what private sector employees are earning, and over a period of a year when bonuses and everything else is played out. So it might not include share options, I can't answer that straight, but I can tell you that the state-owned enterprises and government get a lot more money than government employees. And if you look at the risks and that the people in the private sector face, and that they are the people that are exporting and delivering the services that this economy needs very often, then that's something that's pretty wrong. Steve asked about Nedlac. Let me just say something. I think the problem with a situation where you have these big guys talking is that Nedlac from the business side is going to be dominated by big business. And at this moment in time, if you go back, there was a general secretary of a group called FEDUSA, a trade union group called Ches Milani, who said to me that when it came to small business regulation and everything, the guys from big business didn't care about the small businesses, and they said, no, they must have the same regulations. So yes, some of the mistakes that are coming in come from the business side as well, but that's something that we need to talk about. Regulatory impact studies, let's use a few of those examples. We know that there's a regulatory impact study on the labor market, but it doesn't seem that that's always necessarily going to be a situation whereby people necessarily listen. We know, for example, that the professor who reviewed the four new labor laws has made clear that some of those provisions are not very good. And then, do we always have a regulatory impact assessment? What about the toll roads in Gauteng? Was a regulatory impact assessment done? I don't think an impact assessment was done. These are the type of situations that we're sitting with now. We're going to have toll roads. Listen, you know, you can charge people ever more for the infrastructure that they use because you don't have the government money to spend on the infrastructure. So every piece of infrastructure that we're getting at the moment is paid for by more and more charges. Electricity is going up, rail charges have gone up, port charges are going up, and now our road charges are going up. How are we going to compete with the rest of the world, where, by the way, we've seen the number of people in the labor force worldwide that compete with each other increase from 1.46 billion people in 1990 to over 3 billion people a year or two ago. And these are not my figures. They come from Harvard University, Professor Friedman. And this points out very clearly to you that we've got a very dire situation. We have to compete. And the private sectors are the ones that compete, and they create the value added. There's no way that you can get about that, away from that. The fact is, which sectors in the economy should be creating jobs? If I refer you to my third slide, it shows you that the world's getting older. If the world's getting older, here's a very good idea for you. It means that a lot of advanced economies are going to have to pay pensions to their people at a tremendous rate that they really can't always afford. Maybe we can relieve them of that in a certain way by having pensioners from other countries come here and stay here, and we build the houses for them, that they will create employment for health professionals in South Africa, for people of the domestic workers or whatever you want. But the fact is that it doesn't always have to be industrial. That's the first thing. If you want to know more about sectors, I think there are many, many other aspects that we can do much better in. For example, tourism. We all geared up for the World Cup. But if we actually look at it, South African tourism hasn't really risen. It hasn't risen in the countries that have a lot of money to spend as tourists, because those are the guys that we should be concerned about as attracting to South Africa. And I would suggest that it's something that we make better use of. There are many other aspects, and I think, you know, you can get other economists to tell you. You say I've exaggerated the social grant situation. So the statistics from, very simply put, that we use comes from our own government speeches, where we talk about the 15 million, also the Social Security Agency, and we get tax statistics. We don't know where all those people are employed, but we can find out for you that is available in those tax statistics in which sectors are employed, and that we can work out. But those are the type of statistics that we should be looking at a lot more. And the tax statistics clearly show us that the majority of taxes and the majority of people that are creating companies and all those type of things, you can say poor people pay that as well, you could if you wish, but that's fine. But the fact is that the basis of all those taxes come from many of those people that are creating those jobs in the first place. And on top of that, the people that are working in the private sector and in the government sector, I guess, but the fact is it's coming from those people. And if you think in South Africa that only 41% of all adults work, and anybody who's got a job is already on the richer side of the equation, because rich and poor is a relative term. So anybody in a job in South Africa, by definition, is rich, if you just look at that situation. So you talked about the dignity of a job. I agree, we want the dignity of jobs. And that's what we've got to get at. We can't spend ourselves into a welfare state and get everybody out of poverty. There's no way that we can do that. That's the reality of it. And the 2.1 million, yes, that does start. That comes from the official tax statistics. It's not exaggerated. You can look at the 2009. They were released together with the budget. And it points out to us that 2.1 million people do pay 90% of all personal taxes in South Africa. That's a hard fact. You're entitled to your own opinion, but not your own facts. So those are facts from SARS, and I'm not going to argue. Yes, I raised the cost of Cipro. Let me just make something clear. The fact of the matter is that we have in South Africa, and this is really something that we've got to think through. We've got to get to a situation where we actually start asking, what are all these things doing that we have in government, and all these rules and regulations like a CPRO that comes along? They're supposed to be a property rights organization, a company registration office, all sounds very good. But then they get a life on their own, and they start implementing rules, and that has a cost implication for businesses. And 400 grand isn't that much money for many businesses, I would contend. But it's also the hassle factor that it incurs. And it doesn't stay at 400 grand because you've got to pay another 5,000 rand or so to the accountant, or 1,500. I'm not sure what all the fees of accountants are, I'm sorry. But those are the type of things. Yes, and it brings the accountants money in, and that's great. But for the accountants, that's not their main role. And they saddled with us, and that's what it boils down to. So we must ask ourselves, why is somebody collecting this information and wanting these fees? I'm just asking, what are we doing with that? If we're not doing anything with it, then there's no use, and why should it be there? I'm just asking that question as well. It's true that the paperwork is part of the problem. For business, let me just get this question again. Okay, the 301,000 employees. Okay, let me just say something that needs to be said. There's certainly very big employers in South Africa, and they can afford all the accountants, and they can probably afford all the HR managers, and they can afford a lot of other things. But the guys that are growing the next range of businesses, if you wish, or where we're going to get our jobs from in the future, is not only big business, and they are important. Big business is important. And there's nothing wrong with them. But the fact of the matter is, in many cases, it's the medium and the small businesses that are really having to negotiate a lot of rules. They're going to have to negotiate a heck of a lot of things that we're going through in this country. And it's something that I really suggest, it's not exaggerated, sir. Quite frankly, on the opposite. It's probably not put across well enough. The fact of the matter is, we want to go and get richer. Everybody in South Africa wants to be wealthier. Everybody in South Africa wants the dignity of a job. Everybody in South Africa should have an opportunity to make themselves rich. To deny that opportunity to people, that's inhuman. That's really denying people their human rights. And that's why I'm saying we must care for the rich, and we must have an attitude change. Is government the problem or the role of the state in this crisis, sir? Can I just point out to you? In China, it's the state getting out of the economy that's caused a lot of the growth. That's a fact. And the state, yes, does implement certain things, and we are seeing the same of the state in South Africa. The state was necessary in the crisis. We're not saying let's get rid of the state. That's not what we're saying. We're saying get the state right and do the right things. Let the state provide us with decent, educated humans, people. Let the state provide us with decent infrastructure. And the infrastructure spend in South Africa that the state has done is one of the lowest in the world. And the state does redistribute wealth. We have no problem with redistributing wealth. It's just at some stage, the redistribution starts getting too big, and it becomes a hassle factor for the economy, not just a hassle factor, but it becomes a break on the economy. And there is no other government in the world where there are more people on welfare. There is no other government in the world where there are more people on welfare than there are in jobs. Think about it this way. There are 15 million people on welfare, President Zuma's figures, and there are 13 million people in jobs. That's our labor force. And those people in jobs, by the way, the definition of a job is 1 hour a week. And it doesn't even have to get paid.
Yeah, I'm just being reminded here that as you speak, you must also remember that we've got 10 million children.
That's right. But on welfare, that's fine. But the point is there's no other country in the world that pays out as many grants as we do. There is no country in the world. And And even those countries that do pay out grants, that are emerging market countries like Brazil and Mexico, put conditional grants in place. So in other words, the person that gets the grant, the parent, has to take the kid to full vaccinations. They have to take the kid to school. When the kid leaves school, there's no more grants. Those are the type of things that we should also be thinking about, because we've got to help people help themselves as well. And I think that's important, sir.
Thank you. Thank you. Honorable member, over to you.
Mr. Schussler, are you done? It looks like it, yes. Look at the definition of rich. There will be many definitions. I've got a house manager at my home. In the old terms, we called her a domestic worker. She's a manager, because she managed my home. I'm not there, my wife's a teacher. She's empowered by getting a salary every month. But in the first world terms, she's not rich, because you go by taxi from a home coming to my house to do a day's work. By taxi. When you're rich, you have your own car and you can drive where you want. That's the difference. In terms of the labor laws, very much above what the average is. That's what every South African must do to assist our poor people. Also the legacy where we come from and where we are going to. Honourable members, that concludes the session for this morning. Honourable Mashiri?
Yes, just for 30 seconds, Chair, because Michael did not respond to the question I've asked. If there are hassles of filling in papers or the current corporate taxes, does he conclude that businesses will go out from South Africa and the government collapse? Because that's what he said during his presentation. I actually raised that question. Why did he simplify things that level of administration, paperwork from CIPRO, whatever, and the level of corporate tax that was questioned? Then does it really mean that businesses will reach the conclusion of running away from South Africa, as he tried to communicate to us here? I wanted his comment on that specific one, whether he was really genuine about that fact, or he was just intimidating us to understand
his position. Maybe I should just answer that.
Yes,
we've already lost about 20,000 employers in South Africa, and in that time period we must ask ourselves a question: how many more paper forms did we have then fill in? But regardless of whatever, the fact is it's not about the paperwork, or it's not about one single aspect. I think it's a whole range of aspects that make businesses decide. And I think what we need in South Africa, we need more businesses, and we want to make it as easy as possible for businesses to survive and do their jobs here and to help us to create the jobs that we need. Thank you.
We see our Kenyan delegation is leaving. Thank you for visiting us. Thank you for being present. Honourable members, that brings us to the end of this session. We will now break for lunch for 30 minutes. Please watch your watches. And then Honourable Mufumadi will chair from there, because the National Council of Provinces is having a plenary at 2 o'clock. Then Honourable Mufumadi will take over the chair.
Yeah, thank you. I don't know. Perhaps Mike will not be here when you come back. I just wanted to say, how are you listening to take a good point? Obviously, we'll engage Robert in any presentation.